a sense of, how vast this teaching is, Lee Brasington is going to give a day-long workshop just on right or wise view, which is one part of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so this is really very high-level discussion this evening. So the Four Ennobling Truths are, essentially the first one is there is dukkha. And dukkha is usually translated as suffering, but it's a very subtle term, and what it really means in its finest sense is something we wouldn't even think of as suffering or stress or dissatisfaction. It's the sense of someone that's outside the experience, which is a fabrication of the mind. And that particular, the realization of that is really the freedom that he's pointing us toward. It seems kind of crazy in some sense, but after a while, when one invests, he's not asking you to believe this, he's asking you to explore it. So then the second noble or ennobling truth is that there's a cause for this dukkha. And to keep it simple this evening, he would say basically the cause is attachment, clinging, trying to hold on to things, when fundamentally everything, well, I'll be careful about this, all conditioned things are impermanent, all conditioned things change. There's nothing we can hold on to. The Pali word is anicca, which is usually translated as impermanence, but probably maybe it's even more appropriate is contingency. Everything is dependent. So, for example, the fact that I'm here tonight is a contingency. I didn't expect to be here. Someone couldn't make it, so here I am. It's like we really, we could drive out of leave the center tonight and be in an automobile accident, or we could get some disease or anything like that. Just, we're really not running the show. And the idea that we are and clinging to it is really what causes a lot of unnecessary suffering and stress. And that's what these people in this elders group are starting to see. I mean, they're really faced with it. I mean, I sat up here Tuesday and I looked and I thought, God, all these people are so old, I mean, I'm sort of in denial. I'm a deluded type, I mean, I call them elders because, you'll call them old, but they all know we're old. And then the third ennobling truth is really quite optimistic. He's saying there is cessation. In this very life, we can bring an end to this. I mean, that's a profound and bold statement. So, those are the first three noble truths. There is dukkha, which is, it's not personal. It just, there it is. It's the experience we all have. I mean, we all get old, we all get sick, we all die, we all have lost loved ones, we all lose jobs, and you can bring it down to really minor things like, you got an itchy nose and you don't want it. That's some form of dissatisfaction, right? And then there's this path, which it's an eightfold path, which is this way to realization, to freedom. And the path consists of three basic, it's an eightfold path, but there's three basic components to it. And the first component is the wisdom component, and part of which is wise view, which is what Lee is going to teach a workshop on. And I really, if you can do it, I think it'd be a great thing to do because it's kind of like foundation of this practice in some sense. And then there's the precepts, or guidance to wise action like kindness, compassion, of living a simple life. And then there's what most of us think of as meditation about what this practice is about, which is usually referred to as concentration. But it's not really a good word. It's not a good translation of the teaching. It's probably unification would be a better, or calming, because concentration has too much of a oomph to it. So a lot of practice in the beginning is to create a sense of uplift. And some of you may not believe that meditation creates a sense of uplift because You know, it takes some training, and it's a skill to develop. But really, it is. I mean, I come in here, and I just, man, 45 minutes, like, oh, wow, so great to just do this. And the same thing is true of these qualities of kindness and compassion and simplicity, that when we're really kind to ourselves and others, life just goes easier. We really care for each other. There's a sense of connection. So it's actually, you know, that part of practice, and I talked about this about a month ago, about the Buddha saying, well, one way to language this is to create a healthy sense of self, to really care for yourself, to really care for others, to take care of yourself and be able to develop calm and a sense of ease. And that's hard for people because, I mean, I'm just amazed how hard, I mean, it was, when I started sitting, practicing, I was working 80, 90 hours a week, pumped up on coffee. It's not easy to sit when you do that. And so one of the first realizations when we come to sit is just what a crazy life we live, really. And how out of control we are. I mean, really difficult to sit down and do nothing. Narayan actually talked somewhere, there was some experiment where they had people in a room for 15 minutes and they were just not to do anything. And they preferred to have electric shocks. I mean, it says something about how our minds are. We just really need to train them. So that's the kind of the framework. There's dukkha, there's a cause, which is, you know, in a very simplest sense, clinging to sense experiences, clinging to sense of moi. Think how many times, when you're suffering, notice how many times it's about you, what you want, what you don't want. It's really a psychological kind of thing, right? And there's this promise that there's freedom from this. Maybe not all the time, but it's possible. And there's this path to get there. So that's the Four Ennobling Truths. But what I want to talk about tonight, the title of my talk, Presence of Mindfulness, the Direct Path to Realization, is kind of a little play on a book by a German monk named Manalio. And he wrote a book entitled Satipatthana, the Direct Path of Realization. And Satipatthana is a Pali word which kind of translates as presence of mindfulness. So I put Satipatthana there. Nobody's going to know what the heck I'm talking about, so I put the translation down. And this is amazing. You know, so when Satipatthana Sutta is a discourse. And this is really an amazing discourse. It's, you know, a few pages long. It is so compact, it's unbelievable. I mean, Analio wrote a book on it, his thesis. You know, it's about that thick. There's copies of it in the library called Satipatthana, Direct Path to Realization. Joseph Goldstein gave around 30 talks on it. And so tonight I'm going to just get to it in, you know, 30 minutes or less or something like that. But what's amazing, one thing that's amazing about it is it's really the basis for almost all the teachings in the insight meditation tradition. It's all laid out there in this particular discourse. So the first thing that might come to mind about this, well, we're always told to be mindful. I mean, that's really like this practice is kind of a big piece of the practice. You hear the word mindfulness all the time. But what is mindfulness? And that's really a hard question to answer. My wife says I don't have a compulsive bone in my body, but I actually do. One of them is this obsession about how to say what mindfulness is. And part of the reason is that the word has moved out of the Buddhist tradition into places like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or mindfulness-based stress reduction or mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And you know, the people in those traditions have sort of tweaked the definition to fit their needs and their audience. But it's more than that. Even within this tradition, people talk about what the term means in very different ways. So it can be quite confusing. And I hope I don't just create a whole hornet's nest by saying what I say about it tonight, because it doesn't really matter exactly what it is. What matters is how you practice. Okay. But the word mindfulness is a translation of the Pali word, and Pali is the language that the Buddha's teaching was written down in. It's a textual language. He spoke in a colloquial language. So we have these kind of translation problems here where the Buddha had an experience, the historic Buddha, is a human being. He spoke about the experience in a colloquial language. It got translated into a textual language. And then it gets moved out into an entirely different culture. And we try and talk about it in this language. So you can see that there's some difficulty going on. And language is just, we have no idea how powerful language is. It just influences our perceptions, our way of seeing the world in ways that are unimaginable. There was a study done about languages that focus on being very specific about time, like, you know, I ran yesterday, I'm running today, I will run tomorrow, and languages just say, I run, and without worrying about tense. And the languages where you don't worry about tense, people live healthier lives. That's how strong the influence of language is. It's just a small example, but it's an exhaustive study about this. They don't smoke, they eat better, they're more at ease with themselves, they're healthier. There was actually an interesting little article I came across in some place where it's sort of how to get yourself to follow resolutions, get things done. And they did a study that showed that if you tell someone in June that they have to have something done by December, so like say you say in June of 2014, you have to have it done by December 2014, and you take another group of people and you tell them in July of 2014 they have to do it in January of 2015, the people that do it, it's a 6 month period, right, no matter which group it is, but the people who have it from June 2014 to December 2014 are much more likely to start in time and get things done. It's just a simple notion of it's next year changes our behavior patterns. So language is really a powerful thing. And it turns processes into nouns. That's us. I'm I, a solid, unchanging self. But what we really are processes. And part of that's a function of language. We create this sense of a solid me. Okay. So sati, what people would generally agree on is it has to do with memory. It's not attention. It's to recollect, to keep in mind. And one of the things it helps to do is to focus attention. So if you're doing mindfulness of the breath, sati sort of helps the attention focus. It keeps bringing you back. It makes the attention sustain. That's really what mindfulness, well, that's one definition of mindfulness, is to keep something in mind. Sometimes it's kind of like a monitoring function. One of the monitoring functions is, do we have appropriate attention? So there's a word, manisikara, which means attention. It's different than, it's not sati. Okay, so sati is not attention. And one of the things it does is to check, well, is your attention appropriate? What does appropriate attention mean? It means, is your attention focused on something that's going to help you become free to behave in a skillful way? So it's not like you're just watching things aimlessly. The sati is helping you bring appropriate attention, to watch in a particular way, to have some discernment, some wisdom, which leads to freedom. Now, sometimes the word awareness is used for mindfulness, and it just gets tricky. Maybe I'll try and language another way. It's a kind of a observation knowing. It's sort of this kind of setting back and observing. When I first came to practice, I was taught that it was a mirror-like awareness. It just sees, it's non-judgmental. Which, it's a nice metaphor, but I think it's got a little bit of flaw in it in the sense that it's too cold. The teacher I really like uses the term empathic awareness. It's just this sensitive awareness, this felt sense of how things are. Okay, so that's some flavor of, when we're talking about mindfulness practice, that's kind of what we're trying to do. And the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, this is the translation, presence of mindfulness or foundations of mindfulness or focus of mindfulness tells us what to be mindful of in part. And I got to find my clock here before I get too carried away. The Satipatthana Sutta is really quite interesting and very different than a lot of the teachings in the Buddhist traditions, because I talk, you know, a bit about a lot of our practices cultivating, about cultivating kindness, compassion, a sense of uplifting through meditation. But in the Satipatthana Sutta, the first three or focuses or foundations of mindfulness are, we're just supposed to observe. We're not supposed to do anything at all. Just watch. And there's a good reason for that, because when we try and fix things, we're kind of doing all kinds of unconscious stuff. We can't really observe. It's not like a scientific observation. And in fact, there's all kinds of unconscious suppression, things like that. We have all these views and opinions we bring to things. And what we want to do is understand. And the understanding is just to step back and see what's going on. Okay? So there are four focuses or foundations of mindfulness. Different people translate them in different ways. And the first one has to do with the body. The second has to do with something called vedana, which is a Pali word that basically just means things are pleasant, unpleasant, or are neutral. They don't have much charge to them. The third is mindfulness of citta, which is kind of, citta means mind, heart. So it includes both the conceptual part of what we are as well as emotions. Okay, and then the fourth foundation is really tricky. People kind of do all these twists and stuff trying to explain what it is. It says mindfulness of dharma, or mindfulness of dhamma, which means phenomena. But all the other stuff's phenomena too, so you sort of wonder, well, what is this really? I think Inalio and Joseph Goldstein really call it categories of experience. And I think initially, when the sutta, the discourse, only had two things in it: hindrances, which are basically things that hinder the proper functioning of mind, and factors of awakening. But then, I don't know, as you start seeing more newer versions of the discourse, all kinds of things got thrown in, like the Four Ennobling Truths and the Ten Fetters, and it just goes on and on. So, but basically it has to do with categories of experience, and it's really the one part of the discourse where you're supposed to do something other than just observe. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the first focus or foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. And the Buddha lays out about six different ways to work with and observe the body. So one of them is, you know, to actually observe a corpse. Larry Rosenberg used to talk about how you just go out the charnel grounds. And he said, what is he trying to do here? Well, he's trying to make you aware that, you know, you're going to die. You know, you really are impermanent. Another part of mindfulness of body is contemplating body parts. You know, what we kind of look at this exterior of this 1 millimeter skin layer and hair, and this person's attractive and that person's not, and then we get all, you know, just imagine. I mean, look at what we see, all these images of people who, God, there must be like one millionth of a percentage of people who look that good, and then they also touch them up a little bit, and that's sort of the image that we are supposed to aspire to. And it's just surface stuff. When we really look at what's underneath, there's a heart, there's lungs, there's bones. And he's trying to get us to contemplate that, to see more deeply beyond this kind of concept that we form of who we are, that we're this biochemical process. I talked about this before. In January, I had a colonoscopy. And if you really want to get a sense that you're something different than, you know, this image you have, that's a good start. We're about 90% bacteria and about 10% human cells. But we don't behave that way. We don't, you know, we have this view of what we are, this solid, unchanging me that everything's happening to and that has all these needs. So I mentioned these things. These are kind of things you can explore and get the discourse and reflect on them as, are these useful practices? What I think for me in the early part of practice, that's the most useful part of it, is to be aware of the physical body itself, not from a conceptual perspective, but from just this feeling, it, the experiential, what it is to have a body. And so part of the practice is, you know, where we start often with being aware of the breath. And the way we breathe has a tremendous impact on how we feel. Yeah, if you take deep breaths, the energy level increases. When you exhale, there's a dropping down, a relaxation. And you can learn to play with this. Now, you're told not, you know, some teachers say, well, don't manipulate the breath. But the problem is that we unconsciously manipulate the breath. We often hold it. We don't drop our belly because if we drop our belly, all this tension and fear and all this stuff that we're holding in there will get released. There's a teacher, Ajahn Suchito, who I really recommend that you kind of investigate some of his work. He has a nice little piece out called Clarity and Calm. It's just like a 45-page. It has nothing to do with Buddhism. It's just a 45-page, here's a nice way to make your life much better. And it's just simple things like raising a question periodically, where am I? Now, he doesn't mean to think about, well, I'm in Cambridge Insight Meditation Center in a meditation hall on a cushion. He's actually asking you to come to the body and feel the sense of bodily location. And it's just this pause that gets us out of this head. The body's our ground. The mind just spins. If it does, and it usually finds trouble, right? And thinking wears one out. It really does. You go to work, you don't do anything physically, and you come home, you're tired, right? There's a tremendous amount of energy used in thought. So learning to be in the body really helps ground the mind. You want to embody the mind. I think if you walked out of here with that shift, that would be tremendous. Just to pause periodically, feel the buttocks on the chair, notice your shoulders, let them drop, you know, soften the eyes, soften the lips. Soften the jaws. That's really just a big shift in life. And to make it a real focus, not just do it once in a while, but just get that to be a way to live your life from embodied mind. Because the body doesn't lie. You know, the mind can tell you all these stories about what's good for you and all that sort of thing. But the body, you know, you can feel it all tightened up and, oh, this doesn't feel right, right? So when he talks about the body, the Buddha said, well, be aware of what posture you're in. Be aware when you're changing posture. These are just ways to kind of keep in the body. And when we listen to Suchito, he'll talk about, you know, noticing that, well, you got sides to your body. You can pay attention to the palms of your hand, to the foot. And when you're really stirred up, there are parts of the body that kind of are okay. I always joke my toes, they just deal with anything quite well. You know, so there are parts of the body you can come to when there's really an emotional charge that are somewhat easier to be with. So the hands, the buttocks, the feet. Maybe you're standing somewhere. You just ground yourself in the feet. That's a good way to kind of handle difficult emotions. Now, you know, at some point you want to sort of check out parts of the body like the belly, you know, notice it's tighten and soften it. But there's a lot of emotions there. So this is kind of this balance of not getting overwhelmed and also touching parts that are sensitive. Okay. So that's the first practice, is to work with the body. And it's just something you can really explore. But what I think is really bottom line is to learn to ground yourself more in the body. You can do it all the time. You're checking out, you're waiting in a grocery store. Just come down to the feet and feel them there. Be aware you're standing. I was on a 3-month retreat in England 10 or 12 years ago, and I was coming back from Heathrow Airport, and I was close to the holiday season. So there was like lines, like block. I was so at ease, you know, just, no problem, you know, just sit there. That's possible for us. There's nothing rocket science here. So that's the first focus or foundation of mindfulness. And the second one is vedana, which is just feeling tone. It's not emotions. It's just, does this feel pleasant? Does this feel unpleasant? Does it feel neutral? Okay. And it's really quite useful. I find, like, when I'm having a difficult emotion, sometimes it's just helpful to just say, oh, this is unpleasant vedana. It's just unpleasant, that's all. Now, one of the things that we do in this discourse is the Buddha's really trying to teach us about impermanence. So I think, I don't remember quite the language in the body part, but certainly contemplation of death is a good point towards impermanence. I remember quite how all the other ones go. But, you know, with vedana, He wants you to watch. Sometimes you can actually do a meditation practice and say, oh, it feels pleasant, doesn't feel pleasant, doesn't have much charge. And what you'll notice is none of that stuff stays. It's always changing. And there's no way in the world that you can arrange it to have pleasant feelings all the time. You just can't. Now, I have to tell you that my reaction to impermanence when I first started practice was, yeah, it's impermanent, but I want as much of the good stuff as I can get, you know. But over time, I started realizing that seeing all the effort to line things up so they're pleasant, there's really stress in that. And you can't do it all the time. So if you can really find a way to open to it, to be with it, that's incredibly freeing. Now, the other part of vedana is that what happens is there's so much to talk about tonight. What happens is that at every moment, there's what's called contact. And contact is the sense door, noticing a sense object, and the knowing of it. So consciousness in Buddhism is really limited. It's just something that arises moment to moment when a sense door contacts a sense object. So, you know, I hit the bell, there's ears, object, knowing of it, right? And our life, what we consider moi, is just all this contact, moment to moment to moment. These five sense experiences in Buddhism, the mind is just another sense door. There's a thought, and there's a knowing of the thought. There's a sensing of it, thought. But we get caught up in it. And a huge part of this practice is kind of seeing that this is just all kind of nature playing itself out. That it isn't owned by anyone. So how does the sense of ownership occur? Well, one thing is vedana. You know, it's unpleasant. I want to get rid of it, which is kind of this second ennobling truth. You know, it's like it's either grasping onto or pushing away from something, which creates a sense of time and action. So I was getting ready for this talk, and I'm pretty tired this evening, and I'm really tired, and the next thing you know, vedana, unpleasant feeling, Ah, I'm going to have a little piece of chocolate. That'll make me feel good. It like drives you. I didn't have the chocolate till later. Someone asked me how I give these talks when I'm not feeling well. I said, well, I just get really energized when I come here. And I have a little dark chocolate with some raspberries in it. So when there's contact, it all happens simultaneously. You know, there's the sense door, sense object consciousness, and it just rolls on. And what arises, co-arises at the same time is this vedana, this feeling tone, and something called perception. And perception is just how we recognize things, how we label them. And a lot of it is cultural. Yeah, I used to walk through airports and I'd see people, how they're dressed, what their body shapes were. And then all these kind of, from that simple knowing, that simple perception, a way of labeling things, oh, that's tall, attractive, I don't want to pick up derogatory terms, but they sort of would float through. They're just all learned experiences. And the value of that, and I had a Lynn Whittemore, who's the director of the center, said last weekend, I guess New Year's weekend, she went up with a group and they just talked about perception, starting to investigate how all the way you perceive things affects you. So you might see someone who maybe is a big person or whatever, and then that's a learned experience. Maybe you've had a bad experience with big people or name, whatever kind of characteristic you want, and there's a reaction to that. But these are all learned experiences. And one thing that's interesting is that people are born blind. If they get their sight back, their initial reaction is they don't want it because everything's just wild. They don't know how to separate out things out. It's just overwhelming. We've learned to do that. We've learned to separate out, bodies from open space, trees from open space, and it's a learned experience. And what's interesting then is, so from this contact co-arises feeling and perception, and then we develop more elaborate thoughts and emotions. You have a unpleasant feeling, you also have a perception about something that you don't like, and then you have a reaction to it, and a story gets constructed. So vedana and perception and this contact is a really important piece of practice as to start to see how that works. And I have all kinds of things I was going to say about it, but I'm not going to because I don't have the time. Other than to maybe just with the perception pieces, to realize that all our views and about how we think things should be and all that, a lot of that just comes from very primal instincts. It's not truth. There is, there's some literature out there, there's maybe six primal instincts that sort of helped us survive as a species. Fairness, respect for authority, disgust, which protects us from eating rotten meat and things like that. And basically, what we all think is so logical and rational are just elaborations and justifications of these underlying primal instincts. So we think we're so convinced we're right about things, but it's just kind of the way we're wired. And so knowing that, it's okay to have views and opinions, but it's helpful to realize that, they're relative kinds of constructions and not to get caught in them so much. You're wrong. I can't believe this. I mean, it turns out that people who are very conservative politically have a great deal more inclination for respect for authority and disgust. And people who are more, I don't know what word you use, liberal, have more inclination towards fairness, equity, compassion, and they just get manifested as a thought process. So we're kind of wired that way, and it's helpful to see that we're wired that way, and maybe we still kind of move in that direction, but not to be so kind of rigid about it, to respect that other people just see things differently. My wife's mind works so different than mine, it's unbelievable. And I used to think she was, wow. She didn't show me that part when we were dating, you know. But actually, I mean, there's a tremendous wisdom to that. She sees things, I mean, it says something about your perception of reality. How left brain, right brain you are. And I now have learned a lot from her, and she's learned something from me too, you know. So this is kind of this perception piece. It's kind of a both culturally conditioned from Madison Avenue and that sort of thing, as well as underlying primal drives. Okay. So now I want to get to the part that I really am most interested in, and we're moving. I'm going to talk a little longer than I'm supposed to, I guess. So the third foundation is a focus on of chitta, mind, heart, being aware of the mental piece, and you know, just the conceptual piece as well as the emotional aspects of our life. And so I want to read a little bit of the discourse on this particular section. So he says, and how does a monk remain focused on mind in of itself? And you know, monk, bhikkhu, we're lay people are okay, they can do this too, okay? There is a case where a monk, when the mind has passion, discerns that the mind has passion. So he's just saying, notice, just observe, you have passion. When the mind is without passion, discern the mind is without passion. When the mind has aversion, discern the mind has aversion. When the mind is without aversion, he discerns the mind is without aversion. When the mind has delusion, he discerns that the mind has delusion. When the mind is without delusion, he discerns that the mind is without delusion. Now, this goes, well, it goes quite a way. There's like 16 different of these things. I'll just read a couple more. When the mind is constricted, he discerns that the mind is constricted. When the mind is scattered, he discerns that the mind is scattered. And he goes on and he says, when the mind is concentrated, he discerns that the mind is concentrated. When the mind is not concentrated, he discerns that the mind is not concentrated. So he's just telling, this is part of this stepping back that we all have capability of doing, and just watching what the mind's like. Now, I don't know about you, but it never occurred to me until I came to this practice, well, I did a little bit as a kid, that we could actually step back and not think that everything the mind does is what we are. We can just observe it, and we don't have to believe it. We don't have to get caught up in it. We don't have to see it. That's what we are. He's not telling you to do anything about it at this point. He's just saying, oh, there's passion, there's not passion, there's aversion, there's not aversion, the mind's concentrated, the mind's not concentrated. So we talk about having good sittings. Well, here, it's anything's fine, just as long as you know it's going on. You don't run the show. That's a realization, because you have the delusion that you do, most of you. I don't know. I was on a retreat one night, one time at the Forest Refuge, a long retreat, and it was late at night, and I thought, I'm going to have a good meditation. Boy, that was a setup. And I just couldn't concentrate. So the wise thing to do is say, oh, the mind's distracted, right? That's what this teaching is saying. But I was trying to concentrate. And then I just realized, none of this is me or mine. This is just nature playing itself out. And then there's a sense of ease. All the stuff that's just going on is just nature playing itself out. That's part of what the Buddha is trying to get you to see, that this sense of identity is just a fabrication. So I want to maybe get into that a little bit, and then I'm going to have to stop, and I got another couple hours of talks here if I had time. there's a refrain in every one of these first three focuses or foundation of mindfulness. And the refrain is, in this way, he remains focused internally on the mind in of itself, on externally the mind in of itself, of both internally and externally on the mind in of itself. Now, that's a little bit ambitious. He's saying not only watch your mind, but watch other people's minds. watch both minds, which is useful when you get your practice deepens, because you don't want to just be, when you just focus on yourself, there's a sense of creating a sense of identity and separation. So you start really paying attention to other people as well. There's more of a connection to it. But for a while, just notice the mind, your mind. Where he remains focused on the phenomena of origination with regard to the mind, or the phenomena of passing away with regard to the mind. So what he's trying to do is get you to see it's all impermanent. Absolutely nothing is lasting. Thoughts, you know, a thought arises, contraction arises, passion arises. It's there for a while and it passes away. Now, why does he want to do that? Well, partly he wants to kind of let you be less enchanted by things. He's trying to get you to do that with the body, with Vedana, with perception, with thoughts, emotions. They come and they go. And if we keep trying to hold on to them, line them up, it's not going to work. So we start just seeing they arise and they pass away. Okay. Where he's supposed to see both origination and passing away with regard to the mind, where his mindfulness that there is a mind. To be mindful, there is a mind. So he's stepping back and just saying, oh, there's a mind. It's not your mind. There's something that's just out there that can see there is a mind. I mean, can you really make your mind do whatever you want? It's not yours. Okay. And he remains independent, unsustained, which means not clinging to anything in the world. This is the second noble truth. If you don't cling to anything, you're free. So that's part of what these elders are realizing. You don't cling to everything. Everything is fundamentally okay. So maybe I spend another 5 minutes talking about this. This is really quite profound. He's saying, just observe. He's not saying the mind should be concentrated, that it shouldn't have passion. He's just saying, just see it. And in some sense, it's a form of great acceptance. It's the greatest form of love we'll ever know. It's like, it's okay. Just the way it is. Just total openness to it. There's something whole that's there that just allows it to be. It's amazing because the elders group people know. I think it's so great these people have come to this realization. It's just there, this awareness, this something that holds everything. It doesn't take any effort at all. It's just letting us get out of the way. And there's this knowing that's just there. The words are used, they're like stillness. That's the word that gets used most, stillness. The mind's not fabricating. It's not trying to get rid of things. It's not trying to get things. It's just, right here, right now, you're just now, only this moment, that's it. Everything else is a fabrication. All thoughts about the future occur now, all memories about the past occur now. That's the only moment we experience. And that's really freeing. And sort of relate that a little bit to the physicality of experience. I had some really horrible things happen to a family member. Had no idea how it was going to play out. And one day I was walking out of the house, and I put the key in the door to lock it. And I realized all there is this moment is a feeling of this hand on the key. Everything else, all the thoughts, worries, concerns, are just creations of the minds that cause suffering. It's just that's we do it. The mind does it. So when we start kind of stepping out and saying, this is just nature playing itself out, not identifying with it, there's a level of freedom that occurs. Okay. So when the mind sees, it's just whole. It doesn't judge. Now, the thing is, when we try and fix things, well, I mean, let me just be a little more careful about this. This notion of not doing things, the foundations of the teaching to the direction of freedom, he is saying that the mind and I are not two separate things. Okay, the mind and you are not two separate things. You're not outside the mind controlling it. You are not having a mental experience. You are being held within the mind as a mental experience. The sense of I is a mental experience that's being created. There's not someone outside controlling things. And this really impacts all our practice, because if we were outside the mind, we could control things. And that's what we try and do. But what's really happening is that one part of the mind's fighting another part of the mind. And that's what gives it power. So the experience that I think causes the greatest amount of suffering that I've come across is this inner critic. This sense of inadequacy. If you just tried more, you'd be okay, but you can never do that. It's very harsh voice that jumps on you all the time. But that's just a program. It's a program that's resulted from the society we're in that says you should be like this. And what's this program talking to? A whole bunch of other programs. All these thought processes and stuff are programs running around, conditioned ways of being. And so our lot of practice is just to see that that's what they are. Not to get hooked into them. And another part of practice is cultivating skillful programs. You know, kindness, compassion, simplicity. Because, you know, that way when you have skillful programs, there's enough sense of ease that you can set back and see that they are programs or constructions. Actually, what we think we are these patterns that play out over and over again. I talked about this about a month ago when I talked about karma and the end of karma. Karma is cause and effect. We keep behaving in a particular way. That creates an inclination to behave that way. And then we say, that's what I am. But they're just ways we've been conditioned and conditioned ourselves to be. So the freedom is to step out of all that. Just to open to this moment. Okay. So I think that's where I should stop. The practice is, in the Satipatthana Sutta, mostly about just observing the impermanent nature, selfless nature of things, which is, you know, this anatta, this teaching of not self, is the most profound part of the Buddhist teaching. It's the jewel. And it's not to take away your pleasure. It's actually, you know, a lot of the teaching is to create a healthy sense of self. I don't think that language is really necessary. I think you could use a language to create a healthy group of processes or programs that make you feel uplifted. And that's really helpful, but that doesn't get you there, because no matter how good you are, taking care of yourself, of having positive emotions and all that sort of things, stuff happens. You know, you come out in the parking lot and somebody smashed your car up, or, you know, worse, you get some terrible disease, or you name it. And you're not in control. So the freedom is to realize that. It's not that you don't do things to take care of yourself and all that, but you don't expect that you're going to fix everything. The freedom is in the insecurity of, oh, it'll be okay, which is what the elders group talked about Tuesday. They're really realizing it in the midst of incredible difficulty that fundamentally it's okay, that it's the mind's view about how things should be. Our resistance to unpleasant experiences and always trying to get pleasant experiences, physical, emotional, to add a layer of unnecessary stress and dissatisfaction to our lives. Okay? So I'm going to stop there and just open it up to questions. And it doesn't have to be at all related to what I talked about tonight. Anything that has to do with suffering, stress, and dissatisfaction are fair game in this thing. So, okay.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.